As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
Hello and welcome to The Weekend Intelligence. You're listening to a free episode. To listen every week, you'll need to be a subscriber. For a free trial of Economist Podcasts Plus, click on the link in the show notes or just search Economist Podcasts in your very favorite search engine. The Economist.
Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the moribund Palestinian Authority, has cancelled every presidential and parliamentary election for the past 18 years. His public appearances are increasingly rare and scripted. Abbas is 88 years old, and he sounds it. He often appears half asleep in public. And his people don't like him. Recent polling shows if elections were to be held, he'd capture just 8% of the vote. The man who'd capture the most votes in that hypothetical election? Marwan Barghouti. There's just one problem. Barghouti is in prison and has been for the past 22 years on charges of terrorism. I'm Ore Ogunbiyi, and in this episode of The Weekend Intelligence, Middle East correspondent Nicholas Pelham profiles the man that some are hailing as the next leader of the Palestinian people. A man who could be released as part of a ceasefire negotiation between Israel and Hamas. A convicted terrorist who could become the region's peacemaker.
Marwan Barghouti's popularity increases every day, every year more than the previous year.
For 22 years, Fadwa Barghouti has been his spokesperson. This is her first interview since October 7th. And this is the story of her husband, Marwan.
On the edge of a forest, next to the biblical battlefield of Armageddon, a 64-year-old man sits alone in his prison cell. Since October the 7th, the man has been moved three times. He's currently in solitary confinement, says one of his lawyers. But then he's used to being imprisoned alone. He wrote a book about one such experience. It's called In Isolation for 1,000 Days. It hasn't always been this isolating. Throughout his decades in prison, Marwan Barghouti has filled his time reading and teaching. His family says he's taught hundreds of his fellow inmates. Prisoners call him the professor.
There's a difficult examination inside the jail. Marwan Barghouti, all of the prisoners afraid with Marwan Barghouti. He was very difficult in the exams, not like you, Jamal.
Jamal Hawil, nowadays an economics professor, was once a fellow teacher and prisoner alongside Marwan Barghouti. Inside the prison, a group of men in their middle age, politicians, militants and revolutionaries who knew each other on the outside, are organizing on the inside.
All of time we are teaching the prisoners to write, to read Hebrew and Arabic and sometimes English like this.
Veterans instructing a new generation of activists.
We are sitting, all of us, in a circle, and every week we have one book published in the world, American Samuel Huntington, Fukuyama, like this. We're reading this book and discuss together what happened in the world and what the new in the world.
Marwan is educating himself, his wife Fadwa tells me, to learn languages, to become a better person, to become a better leader. His son Arab says the family has sent Marwan thousands of books during his more than two-decade incarceration.
One time I asked him for a list of his favorite books. He sent me a list of 180 books. So I told him, no, I think this is way too much. And I asked him to just choose one. And he couldn't. He couldn't choose one. But then he told me that I should read Sapiens, which is interestingly so. It's an Israeli writer, Yuval Harari, that talks about human history.
Palestine's most famous prisoner tells his son to read a book by one of Israel's most famous authors.
And it was such an amazing book. He recommended that.
Prison visits are an indelible memory of Arab's childhood.
Between the ages of, 12, 13 to 16, in those 3-4 years, my childhood is all about the visitation, because if you go twice a month, you wake up at 5 a.m., you leave and you go through checkpoints and humiliation and all of that, and you wait at the door of the prison, sometimes under the sun, sometimes under the rain, and you stay there for hours and hours and hours just to see him for 45 minutes where you're not allowed to touch him. So the whole journey is between 20 and 22 hours just for those 45 minutes. And I learned how the prison authority and the Israeli government is eager to make sure that the families are suffering, not only the prisoner.
In hindsight, those were the good years. It's been more than a year and a half since Arab last saw his father. Marwan Barghouti was born in a village called Kobar in 1959. The village is perched on the hills of the West Bank. You can see the skyscrapers of Tel Aviv and the Mediterranean Sea far off to the west. Along the sides of the winding, narrow road into the village, almond trees are just beginning to blossom. Facing the other points of the compass, across small valleys, are three Israeli settlements. Western, suburban-style homes dot those hills. Each is surrounded by a security fence. Marwan grew up here with seven siblings. One of them, his brother Mukbil, gives my producer and I a tour. As we walk down one of the village's few roads, a man drives by and yells, "Isbua! Isbua! 1 week! 1 week!" Perhaps he's joking, perhaps he's serious. He's predicting it will be one more week until Marwan is released. Hope, like Koba's almond trees, springs eternal. Mukbil says the Barghoutis make up about a third of the population here. The village is poor. Many of its people are labourers. But opportunities have shrunk since October the 7th, when Israel prohibited Palestinians in the West Bank from crossing into Jerusalem and the Jewish settlements to work. Mukbil shows us the modest home where he and Marwan grew up. Back then, it was just two rooms. Side by side, six people sleeping in one, three sleeping in the other, which was also the kitchen. Now it's much bigger. They've built a bathroom and a top floor. The basement, where the kids lived decades ago, is full of farm equipment and hay. But back then, Israel's occupation was just a few years old. The Jewish settlements had yet to sprout on the hills. Marwan was just 13 when his dog barked at an Israeli patrol, and troops shot it dead. That, says his family, is where his activism began. But his village does have a long history of resisting occupation. Mukbil tells stories of villagers who died fighting the British and Ottoman empires. Generations of people from Khobar, he says, have spent years in Israeli prisons. Around town, there are signs of a community on the front lines. Pictures of Yasser Arafat, the longtime leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, in his iconic black and white keffiyeh. Photos of fighters killed by Israeli forces. Hamas flags. And graffiti. One reads, "Ripe with flowing blood, death to Israel." As the sun sets on Khobar, one of the village's two mosques calls people to pray. Down the hill a bit from the mosque, a teenage girl stands outside a block of flats with other young women and girls. She tells us things are dire in Khobar and Palestine more broadly, particularly since October the 7th.
Checkpoints have become more strict. The Israeli occupation are attacking the villages much more often, and a lot of prisoners have been taken compared to our situation before the war.
But she hopes the release of Marwan will change that.
He resembles our freedom and our will to stay strong as Palestinians.
Marwan Barghouti's stencil is plastered in cities throughout the West Bank. There's a giant mural of him on the barrier wall that cuts the West Bank off from Jerusalem. It says, "Free Barghouti." Next to his image is a painting of a masked Palestinian launching a heart from a slingshot. For a long time, people here have been looking for a saviour, someone to lead them to peace and prosperity, someone to negotiate a two-state solution. They need that now more than ever. Many Palestinians believe Marwan Barghouti is that saviour. But many Israelis are horrified by the idea of a convicted terrorist leading a future Palestine. Me, I've been hearing about Barghouti for the last 30 years. I've come here to get a sense of the real Marwan Barghouti and whether Palestinians are right to pin their hopes on him.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
Peter. Thank you.
I start to take my shoes off as I enter Fadwa's flat, but she tells me not to worry. Fadwa Barghouti tells me that her husband's political activity began as a teenager. Before he was even 18, she says, Marwan was elected as a head of Khobar's football club.
Marwan has never been appointed to any position in his lifetime. You can go to his record, his career. You'll find that he was elected to every single position in his life. He's a big believer in democracy.
That makes him very different from President Abbas's loyal band of appointees, which runs the West Bank and has repeatedly cancelled elections. Marwan's belief in democracy even governed life at home too, says their son, Arab.
I still remember when we used to, when we were young and we used to start debating to choose the restaurant or the place that we want to have lunch. He would give us elections between the four, like me and my siblings. And this instilled democracy from a very young age that you should ask for everyone's opinion.
So he says democracy had its limits because sometimes Marwan would just go with Fadwa's vote.
Yeah, sometimes he would make my mom's vote the deciding one.
Most of the West Bank's leaders now live on the outskirts of Ramallah, in a gated community known as the Diplomatic Quarter. Its spacious red-roofed villas remind some Palestinians of an Israeli settlement. But Fadwa lives in a block of flats in the heart of Ramallah with a shaky lift that climbs up to their floor. Fadwa is waiting for us as we walk in. She wears a black top and trousers. Her hair is combed back, revealing her strong forehead. Hers is a strangely impersonal flat, lacking in intimacy, as if she was waiting for Marwan to return home to decorate it. Instead, it feels much like a campaign office. The beige floor tiles and walls are spotless. There's a lot of furniture for visitors. Sofas and chairs line the walls. And instead of family photos, there are portraits of Marwan Barghouti everywhere, hands clenched over his head in victory.
Yeah. Who's that?
Fadwa is too preoccupied to offer coffee or make small talk. She just wants to talk about Marwan. When her husband was locked away, Fadwa became Marwan's voice to the outside world. She travelled to European capitals, to Robben Island in South Africa, to lobby for Marwan's release. She even represented him in the parliamentary election President Abbas called in 2021 and then cancelled on the eve of the vote when Marwan was poised to win, from jail. For over 20 years, whatever Palestinians know of Marwan, they know through Fadwa. Fadwa is also from Khobar. She and Marwan went to high school together. They knew each other as friends. Marwan was embroiled in politics even then. At 15, he joined Arafat's secular nationalist movement Fatah, which advocated armed struggle long before the formation of Hamas and was the driving force in the PLO. While he was still at high school, Israeli soldiers detained Marwan and a court convicted him of membership of an armed group. He says he was beaten in the genitals to extract his confession. Fadwa started to hear about him in the news and became interested in his activism. The two began exchanging letters.
I was not allowed to visit him because we didn't have an official relationship. That's why I would deliver messages to him through his siblings or his mom.
Call it courtship through correspondence. They married soon after his release in 1983. Back then, Marwan had a thick mane of jet black hair. His eyes sparkled, slightly mischievously. He exuded Palestinian grit, the rebel with a cause. She was always the sober one, slightly taller, and though younger, seemingly more mature, trying to keep him in check, but failing to stop him from getting in trouble. Marwan enrolled in college at nearby Birzeit University, the breeding ground for an upcoming generation of Palestinian leaders. He led student rallies. He launched a Shabiba, the student wing of Fatah. And then he got arrested again. On a December morning in 1987, an Israeli truck driving along a street in Gaza City ploughed into a car, killing four Palestinians. It might just have been a road accident, but it ignited the first intifada. It set off years of clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians. For the first time, young Palestinians took charge of the struggle for liberation, while veteran leaders in the diaspora like Arafat looked on. Students with Marwan at the helm led the way and were hauled off to jail. Marwan, now 25, was detained and deported to Jordan, along with Fadwa and their young family. At the time, Jordan was a hub of Palestinian activism. Half the kingdom's population was Palestinian, and Marwan quickly made a name for himself. He was elected to Fatah's Central Committee, the youngest member of the movement's governing body. But Marwan was a street fighter. In Jordan, there was no occupation to resist or troops to defy. The next 7 years in the Jordanian capital, Amman, were the quietest of Marwan's life. The couple did what others do in their 20s and focused on raising a family. In between her studies, Fadwa travelled back to Jerusalem alone to give birth to Arab, their youngest, so that Israel wouldn't take away his residency rights.
The 7 years that Marwan was in Jordan
For a time, it felt normal. Fadwa and Marwan had never spent so much time together. But normality, says Fadwa, just made him restless. He began to vegetate. All he wanted was to return to Palestine. And eventually he did, because of an agreement signed thousands of miles away.
We have come from Jerusalem, the ancient and eternal capital of the Jewish people.
On September the 13th, 1993, on the White House lawn, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin told the Palestinian people that they and Israelis were destined to live together.
We have come from an anguished and grieving...
The signing of the Oslo Accords was a monumental moment in the peace process. Rabin and Arafat shook hands. For the first time, Israelis and Palestinians agreed to suspend violence and work towards a peaceful solution to the decades-long conflict. The PLO recognized the State of Israel, and Israel recognized the PLO as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people.
We have come to try and put an end to the hostilities so that our children, our children's children, will no longer experience the painful cost of war, violence and terror.
As part of the agreement, many deported Palestinians were allowed to return. One of them was Marwan. His exile had ended.
When they announced that he would be going back to Palestine, I've never seen him happier than that in my whole life.
But before he could return, there was one more task. He was asked to lead the Palestinian delegation in front of King Hussein of Jordan. Amid the pageantry, he made an odd sight.
Marwan is very casual. He doesn't like to wear suits. But that day, he was supposed to wear a suit, and his suit was in the luggage already, because it was right before we were leaving for Palestine. And I took the suit out of the luggage and tried to make it look nice, because it wasn't ironed or anything.
Marwan thanked the king for his hospitality and invited him to join them, inshallah, God willing, in Jerusalem. And then they took the bus over the little river of Jordan and jubilantly into Jericho, the oldest city in the world and the first from which Israeli forces withdrew after 26 years of occupation. Fadwa says the bus ride was filled with joy. People felt freedom. Crowds thronged the returnees, and Marwan grabbed the microphone to celebrate his return. The Oslo Accords launched a period of unrivaled optimism among Israelis and Palestinians for mutual recognition, for two states, for an end to violence. It was captivating, almost surreal. Old walls of conflict seemed to come tumbling down across the Middle East. I was living in Egypt at the time and remember the excited press conferences as President Hosni Mubarak took the stage with Arafat and Rabin at his side. We were witnessing history in the making. But at the same time, there was this gnawing concern. The imbalance of power between Israelis and Palestinians remained. Israel had given nothing it couldn't take away. Palestinians had paid up front with recognition of Israel on over three quarters of the land they had fought over. But Israel's handover on less than a quarter was left to dangle in successive stages. Palestinians had accepted Palestine on trust. In the moment, though, Oslo felt like a game changer. For the first time, Palestinians had their own parliament in their own land. Marwan won a seat. And more women, says Fadwa, voted for Marwan than men. From the floor of the chamber, he calls for the establishment of a parliamentary committee for women's rights and faces strong opposition from conservatives. As he sees it, says Fadwa, women's liberation is part and parcel of Palestine's. Other Arab leaders hide their wives from view. Marwan encouraged Fadwa to enter public life.
He supported me unconditionally and pushed me even to complete my studies and then my master's degree. He would take care of the children while I was doing that.
Fadwa became a lawyer in Ramallah and launched her own office.
I was a very good lawyer and used to make really good money.
Still in their 20s, the couple from Khobar had made it. They were back in Palestine with their children. She became an accomplished lawyer. He was a politician with a popular following. He was known.
He was educated. He was a very sharp guy. In my opinion, he supported peace. Totally. Real peace with Israel. He would like very much, he and his people. They wanted to see peace with Israel.
As a member of parliament and a rising star in Fatah, the Oslo period thrust Marwan to the forefront of the new era of Israeli-Palestinian cooperation and peace. That's how Marwan Barghouti met Meir Shitrit, a rising star in the Knesset. He would become Israel's Minister of Finance, of Justice, of Interior.
I'm the only one who supported Oslo from the Likud. I'm the only one. So the idea came, how can we make, how can we know each other?
Like Marwan, Meir Shitrit was a street kid. He arrived in Israel as a young refugee from Morocco. The authorities sent him to live in what they called a development town. But back then, it was little more than a camp. He could have moved north to the big city, Tel Aviv, but he stayed put, first as a protest leader, demanding state support for his town, and then as its local mayor. Today, he embodies the elite that he used to struggle against. We sink into his huge leather couches. His walls are covered, ceiling to floor, with paintings. His back doors slide open to a manicured garden and pool. Though Meir was a member of Israel's right-wing party, Likud, he was also swept up by the euphoria of the Oslo signing. Together, they joined parliamentary delegations promoting the pathway to peace. Sometimes they met in Ramallah, the new Palestinian seat of government in the West Bank. Sometimes in Israel, and sometimes in European resorts. One of their last meetings was in Italy in the late 1990s.
We have a dinner together in one restaurant, very nice restaurant. We sit until 12 o'clock at night or something like that, telling jokes about Arafat and about Bibi, about everybody was telling jokes from his side. We were laughing it all the time.
Bibi is Netanyahu's nickname. They were so close that they mocked their own leaders to their former foes. And one night, after supper, Meir fell ill, very ill. Another Israeli parliamentarian tried to help, but the only person Meir wanted at his side was Marwan.
And I said, look, call Barghouti. I feel very bad. And he went up, called Barghouti. Barghouti came to my room.
Marwan found Meir trembling, in bad shape.
I couldn't speak, nothing. They put me in the bed. He went and bring back all the covers of all the members of the delegation and put over me. And a seat over me to try to stop the trembling. And they stay with me until around 2 or 3 o'clock, I started to relax.
All night, Marwan lay with Meir, comforting him and keeping him warm.
I felt totally tired. I was sweating and feel very bad. And I said to Barghouti, look, Barghouti, I have flight at 5 o'clock in the morning. I want to go home. I said, you please stay here and wake me up 5 o'clock so I can catch the flight. Don't leave. He said, no problem. Why? Said, don't worry at all. I stay here. I'm not going anywhere. And he stayed with me. 5 o'clock, he woke me up. I went to the airport and I flew back home.
The connection the two men developed over this period was a product of Oslo. Meir was convinced that Marwan wanted to live at peace in a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. But Marwan wasn't just a politician, a peacemaker. He was the darling of the Palestinian street. After a lifetime in exile, Arafat needed young Fatah activists to shore up his base in Gaza and the West Bank. Marwan was charged with establishing a grassroots paramilitary force of Fatah loyalists called the Tanzim. From the first day of his return from Jordan, Israel's intelligence services were watching Marwan and befriending him too.
I was standing in Ramallah and in Bethlehem while the Palestinian soldiers, while they came from Jordan. I still remember the rally, looking to them and saw them with their Kalashnikovs, with the AK-47. It was a very sensitive picture.
That soft-spoken voice is the Israeli spy in charge of the Ramallah area at the time. He says he'd like me to refer to him by his nom de guerre, Abu Farah. They all have Arabic nom de guerre at the Shabak, Israel's intelligence agency. Abu Farah recalls that the first time they spoke was when the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces told him to get Marwan on the phone.
He told me Marwan Barghouti already knows that you are about to call him. So I've made a telephone call to Marwan Barghouti and I say, hello, that's my name. I'm in charge from the Shabak on the West Bank, and let's have a coffee. And he invited me for the first coffee to his office in Ramallah.
Abu Farah and I chat on benches outside a Tel Aviv mall as security guards lock up the place for the night. He's understated. He looks average. Black jacket, stocky build, short cropped grey hair. There's nothing flashy about him. Nobody recognises him. He's more George Smiley than James Bond. That's how he seems to like it. In a post-Oslo era, he and Marwan became partners.
He was somebody that you could think about him as a future leader.
They talked about family, mixing Hebrew and Arabic, and they spoke about their common foes. Top of the list was Hamas, the Palestinian Islamist movement, which had been left out of the Oslo talks. It opposed any deal that shared the land with Israel.
We had several meetings, not in open places, and we spoke about how to work together, how to deal together against terrorists. One of our main concerns, we understood that Hamas will be against the Oslo agreement because it is a peace agreement. And basically, we understand that Hamas will try to destroy it.
A few months after the signing of Oslo, Hamas began sending suicide bombers onto Israeli buses. The escalating attacks added a degree of urgency to their meetings. Marwan, says Abu Farah, was helpful, but only so far.
You know, behind the good atmosphere and the good relationship, I cannot tell you that he led me to Hamas infrastructure in Ramallah to arrest them. No, absolutely not. But, you know, for the beginning, for good relationship, that I have your phone number, you have my phone number, we can talk to each other in emergency situation, it's important.
While Hamas worked to undermine Israeli confidence in Oslo, Israel's religious right, who were equally opposed to dividing the land, worked to do the same to Palestinian confidence.
Tonight, tonight at 11:10 p.m. as an outcome of murderous criminal assassination attempt, the Prime Minister of Israel and the Minister of Defense, Mr. Yitzhak Rabin, passed away. He was hit by 3 bullets in his chest and his abdomen.
In 1995, a young right-wing Israeli assassinated Rabin. It paved the way for Netanyahu, an opponent of the Oslo Accords, to become prime minister. Indirectly, Netanyahu owed his election to pro-settlement Israelis, and they formed an alliance. Together, they accelerated the expansion of settlements deep in the West Bank. Hilltops sprouted with cranes and Israeli flags. From inside Palestinian cities, it felt the occupation was more coming than going. For many Palestinians, Oslo increasingly looked like a ruse. Fearing the peace process was slipping away, Marwan toured Israel urging its political factions, whatever their hue, to keep the Oslo process from unravelling. But unravelling it was. In the summer of 2000, talks between Israelis and Palestinians in America collapsed. In Jerusalem, the leader of Likud, Ariel Sharon, walked onto the sanctuary housing the Golden Dome of the Rock, staking Israel's claim to the site Palestinians demanded as the centerpiece of their future capital. Protests quickly followed. And in Ramallah, Yasser Arafat fanned the flames. "With our souls and our blood," he chanted, "we will redeem you, O Palestine." Until Jerusalem, until Jerusalem, until Jerusalem. To his audience, it sounded like a call to arms. Abu Farah, Israel's blink and you'd miss him spy, began to see a change in his old confidant.
And I think that Yasser Arafat, at that time, he didn't say it. Maybe he didn't say it very clear and very loud, but he gave them the feeling that making the switch from peace to terror, it's okay, it's fine.
For years, Marwan Barghouti and his Fatah colleagues had pursued the path of peace. Now, it was time to change tack. The uprising became known as the Second Intifada. From day one, Israel shot at the protesters. Shootings led to car bombs to assassinations, assassinations to suicide bombings, and suicide bombings to raids back into the cities Israel had left. In a rally from the time, Marwan calls for lighting the fires of another intifada. Reluctantly or not, Abu Farah says Marwan and his paramilitary group, the Tanzim, played a key role.
I think that within the beginning of the Second Intifada, Barghouti, as other Fatah people, they started to think that maybe if they would like to keep their position at the street, if they would like to stay in power at the streets, they must do something.
And the Israelis weren't the only ones to notice a change in Marwan. Samer Sinjelawi was Marwan Barghouti's assistant during the Oslo years.
The good leader is the one that affects the people, but sometimes decide to be responsive to the mood of the people, not always affecting. Marwan always wanted to be number one.
For him, Marwan's reaction was more emotional than rational.
He has done a miscalculation in 2002. He risked his own life and freedom to gain popularity.
Why did he do it?
I guess he, poetically, it was more poetic. It was more, you know, it was the mood. And he couldn't be something else. He can't see himself different than what is a mood, a general mood, a public mood. Okay, I don't think that it is more strategic and planning.
Back in Ramallah, drinking Turkish coffee in her sitting room, Fadwa demurs when I ask her whether her husband changed tactics and adopted violence during the Second Intifada.
By nature, Marwan is not a violent person at all. He doesn't prefer it. But he used to always say if the political solutions are a dead end, the Palestinian people have the right under international law to struggle against illegal occupation.
In the West Bank, Marwan again became the face of the Intifada. But this time it was different. Palestinians fought with guns, not stones. Old friends in Israel, like Meir Shatrit, accused him of launching the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, a militant wing of the Tanzim that competed with Hamas by recruiting its own suicide bombers.
I called him during the Intifada. I said, and I told Barghouti, don't touch terror. Don't touch it. Go away from it. Don't touch. Listen, I'm warning you, don't touch terror.
Shatrit tried to steer him away from hotheads that picked up arms. Marwan escaped several assassination attempts, including an Israeli missile strike on his car. And as Israeli forces laid chase a year into the Intifada, he went underground, hiding out, sleeping in different places each night. On April the 15th, 2002, he was captured by Israeli commandos inside one of his safe houses in Ramallah and interrogated for months by Abu Farah's intelligence agency, the Shabak. Often the sessions went on through the night. When Marwan slumped back in his chair, nails would pierce his skin, says his family. When he leant forward, nodding off, his interrogators would slap their hands on the table in front.
Look, it's interrogation. You know, interrogation, it's nobody's volunteer to tell you something that will send him to jail to the rest of his life. But he told us the whole story.
Abu Farah has no doubt about Marwan's complicity.
He was the leader. He gave the order. He gave the order. He didn't connect the wires of the device. He gave the order. He was the commander. He was the leader for those people. They saw him as a leader. I don't know if he told them that's an order I've got from Yasser Arafat. He said, I'm the commander. I'm the leader. It's not fighting for freedom. You know, to put a bomb, an explosive device into coffee house. He did it after sitting with us. He was a partner.
Once the interrogation period was over, Israel's justice minister put him on trial, not in a secret military tribunal, but in a public civilian court in Tel Aviv. And that justice minister, Meir Shatrit, the man Marwan cared for in Italy.
He judged not in a court, army court. Okay? He was judged in a regular court. I make the decisions, Minister of Justice, because I want that his trial will be open to everyone to see really what happens.
Marwan's supporters called it a show trial. He was led into a courtroom full of Israeli officials, journalists and television cameras. Hidden among them was his youngest son, Arab.
I was barely 13 years old. And when we got to the courtroom, it, like you could feel the energy is so intense. And I saw that there were some people, I realized later that they were settlers, and they were waiting for him. They were looking like, I can tell you that this was absolutely the first time that I see hatred in faces towards me, not towards only my father. And that was shocking to me because I didn't understand what was happening. But with all that darkness, I will never forget the moment that he got into the court and he looked at us and gave us his magical smile. And I think that at that moment, everything disappeared. Like, I didn't feel that there was any court, any judges, any guards. And I started running to him. It was benches, so I started jumping on the wood benches. And that's exactly where the settler slapped me, and I fell on the floor.
The cameras also played to Marwan's advantage. As Marwan saw his son, his eyes lit up. He broke into a smile. He raised his cuffed hands over his head, clenched them, and cried, "Freedom."
The policy of occupation will not lead for the security. Security will be achieved.
In the end, he was convicted for 4 attacks. They included a shooting in a fish restaurant in Tel Aviv. The gunman's drivers, the court heard, had called Marwan shortly after the attack. And the killing of an Orthodox priest, a case of mistaken identity. Marwan's supporters say the charges are trumped up, based on confessions extracted under torture. At the age of 45, he was sentenced to 5 life terms and 40 more years. One of the photos from the time shows a policeman with his arm wrapped around his shoulder, escorting him out of court. Marwan is still smiling, albeit a little less triumphantly. He lifts his shackled right hand, calmly waving goodbye, as if suggesting he will soon be back. That was 2 decades ago. In recent months, the precinct outside the court where Marwan Barghouti was sentenced in Tel Aviv has been rebranded. It's called Hostage Square, a monument to the Israelis who remain in Hamas captivity. Hamas's negotiators in Qatar say they have put Marwan at the top of their list of prisoners they are demanding in exchange for the hostages they captured on October the 7th. The Islamist movement wants to show it's acting for all Palestinians, not just its own. Its leader, Yahya Sinwar included, knows Barghouti personally from their long spells in prison together. They've worked to end the rift between their respective factions, and the movement still looks to Barghouti as a unifying figure who can bridge the divide between the West Bank and Gaza and restore Hamas to the Palestinian fold.
You mentioned Marwan Barghouti.
Yeah, the suffering of his family. Marwan Barghouti killed tens of Israeli citizens.
At a rally organized by Israel's government in March for the families of the Israeli hostages in Gaza, relatives spoke of their outrage, humiliation and pain that their captives might be exchanged for Marwan Barghouti. Yehuda Cohen's 19-year-old son, Nimrod, was a soldier on Israel's border when he was kidnapped by Hamas. Yehuda says he's open to a deal to release the likes of Marwan Barghouti for his son.
Now I'm thinking of my personal interest, my son's interest. Yes, I would agree that my government will release cold-blooded murderers for the release of my son. Yes. What will happen after that? That's a different story.
Other Israelis, though, are not so willing. A mix of trauma, trepidation about a future with Barghouti in charge, and even a desire for revenge, continues to shape Israeli thinking since October the 7th. And that anger coursing through Israeli society fills Fadwa with fear. There are harrowing accounts from fellow inmates of the new prison regime Israel's far-right National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, has introduced since Hamas's attack. Deaths in custody in Israeli jails are at their highest for decades. The family fears Marwan might add to the tally. Even if he were released, it's hard to know whether Marwan could simply pick up from where he left off. Israel and Palestine look very different today. And Marwan looks different too. The last photo the world has of him shows a much older man than that entering the courtroom 2 decades ago. It's all too reminiscent of those old men in power he used to rail against. Gone is that shock of black hair and the fiery eyes. His scalp is bald, his beard is white. And that was from 8 years ago. His family says he's further aged since, but insists he's not lost the stamina to keep struggling. He's now in his mid-60s, and his prison conditions are unlikely to help. His lawyer and testimony from an inmate say he's back in solitary confinement. He's been put on reduced rations. He's been blindfolded, stripped naked and left in the dark. They say he's received repeated beatings. He has a gash above his eye that medics haven't treated. The Barghouti family says that they have not been able to speak with Marwan since October the 7th. Neither has the International Committee for the Red Cross. And the American government is also reported to have voiced its concerns. But Israeli officials deny any knowledge of the alleged mistreatment. But for Palestinians, his absence has only made the heart grow fonder.
During the last 20 years, Barghouti has been the most popular in all the surveys we have conducted.
Indeed, according to Khalil Shikaki, director of the Palestinian Center for Social and Policy Survey Research, he's the most popular leader since Arafat.
He was able to win in every single survey we have conducted since that time. He is seen as a unifier, that he would be the person to reconcile, bring in Fatah and Hamas together and reunify the West Bank and Gaza. He is seen as tough on the Israelis, unlike Abbas, who is seen as someone who makes deals with the Israelis in order to survive in his position as president of the Palestinian Authority.
We don't know how Marwan would act if he were to be released. Has the peacemaker-turned-firebrand renounced violence? Will he return to the role of peacemaker once more? And could an old man still capture the zeitgeist of a young population? Meir Shatrit, that old friend turned justice minister who put him on trial, once again says Marwan is the one who can unlock the conflict, defeat Hamas at the polls, and lead Palestinians to a state in peace with Israel.
It would depend on me. I would release him. I would pardon, giving him possibility really to be a leader of the Palestinian and to establish a Palestinian state, which will live in peace with Israel. That's the Barghouti I knew.
Fadwa just wants her husband home and seeing a long-ago promise being fulfilled.
I will always remember the promise that he made to me 40 years ago when he told me that one day, when Palestine is free, I will be back as a family guy. And until then, unfortunately, I'm not able to play that role. So I can't wait for Palestine to be free, just to have that normal life.
It's not just Fadwa that wants a normal life. It's every Israeli and Palestinian. Fadwa has never been more hopeful for Marwan's freedom and more afraid for his death. His fate could be a metaphor for the bigger conflict.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Weekend Intelligence, which was reported by Nicholas Pelham and produced by Peter Granitz. The sound design was by Nicholas Rawfast, and the executive producer of The Weekend Intelligence is Gemma Newby.
Thank you. World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.